Hi, friends. Greg Kokel here, and I am out of town this week. So instead of our usual podcast, I want to give you a taste of our other podcast, hashtag STRAsk. And that's where Amy and I answer questions sent to us on Twitter. And if you like what you hear, look up hashtag STRAsk, all one word, on iTunes or your podcast app and subscribe. So now, enjoy this episode of hashtag STRAsk.
Hello, you're listening to the hashtag STRAsk podcast with Amy Hall and Greg Kokel.
Hi, Amy.
Hello, Greg. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and thanks for sending us your questions. Basically, what we do is you send us your questions on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk, and then we answer them in a short amount of time, sometimes shorter than other times.
Sometimes better answers than other times, too.
So let's start today with MB. I have recently encountered Torah observant Christians. They believe in salvation by faith alone, but believe eating kosher, keeping the Sabbath, celebrating the feast, etc., pleases God and is how Christians should live. What would you say to them?
I would like to know why they think that's the case. I don't see any reason whatsoever to think that God is happy when Gentiles celebrate Jewish feasts. I'm a little bit speechless here because I'm trying to figure out what the rationale is there. Now, let me make a foundational point that I think for some people will be a little bit shocking, but if they just take a deep breath and think about it for a moment, it seems to me, incredibly obvious. There is not a single thing in the Mosaic Law that is incumbent upon any Gentile simply because it's in the Mosaic Law. Period. Wow, that seems so crazy. You mean not even the Ten Commandments? And my response is not even the Ten Commandments. But let me say this again so you don't misunderstand. There is not a single thing in the Mosaic Law that is incumbent upon any Gentile in virtue of it being in the Mosaic Law. Now, I'll get to the moral thing about the commandments in a moment, but here's the rationale behind it. The Mosaic Covenant is a testament. It is a contract. It is a legal document between two parties. The parties are God and the Jews, period. A contract is only binding on the parties that it's between. Gentiles have no place in the contract God made with the Jews. Now, whether or not that contract is still binding on Jews, that's another issue, but it was never, ever binding on Gentiles per se, with the, in a certain sense, the exceptional circumstance when the Gentiles came into the Commonwealth. While they were in the Commonwealth with the Jews, they lived under Jewish law. Okay? But that's only because now they were in the Commonwealth. I'm from Illinois, but I live in California. There is not a single moral obligation of any Illinois statute that has any application to me whatsoever while I am not in the state of Illinois. And if I visit, even as a resident of California, I'm still under those statutes. Now, there is a statute in Illinois against homicide. Does that mean I can kill? I'm not in the state of Illinois, so I don't have to keep its statutes. Right, I don't have to keep its statutes when I'm outside of the state of Illinois, but I still have to keep other statutes. And so there are statutes in God's mind, moral obligations that apply to Gentiles that are unrelated to the Jewish law. They are just universal moral obligations that, because they're universals, show up in the Mosaic Law. But I don't obey the commandment not to murder because it's in the Jewish law. I obey it because it's God's law. It's transcendent God's law is what I'm saying. It is wrong for anyone to murder anywhere, and we know this in the New Testament. It talks about this kind of thing, and irrespective of the Mosaic law, because this is God's universal command, and that's why it shows up in the Mosaic law. Okay, so now I've bridged two chasms here. I've made a statement that is extreme at first. There's nothing in the law that applies to us as Gentiles in virtue of it being in the law. I'm not saying, by the way, that there's nothing we can learn from those things and find principles. Yeah, there's plenty for us to learn, but we are not obliged by the requirements of that law because that law is a contract between God and Israel. Okay. And so hopefully I've clarified that particular point. The reason is it's a contract between two parties and we're not one of those parties. And the second thing is that doesn't mean we could just live like hell because we have moral obligations upon us as human beings by God. Some of those moral obligations, I actually think 9 of the 10 commandments fall under that category, with the exception of the Sabbath, apply to all human beings everywhere. And we see repeated in the New Testament regarding. So there are some things that are obliged to do, but not because it's in the Mosaic covenant. Now, with that as a foundation, that's my doctrinal foundation, what is the rationale then someone would give for saying, oh, it pleases God for me to keep the traditions and the requirements of the Jewish people that God arranged with them in the contract at Sinai? And by the way, they can't keep them all because a whole lot of things it's impossible to do that were commanded. And that would be sacrificing the temple and stuff like that. So I don't know why I genuinely do not understand the justification they offer for that. But there's the rationale against the notion. Now, if somebody wants to do that for fun and they are doing it in a way of remembering something great that God did, they do the Passover and participate in that because it's a rich ceremony in which God is remembered in terms of what he did with the Jews, etc. That's fine. And I think in a sense, insofar as this attempt is to glorify God in the participation of that, God is honored, God is pleased, but he's not pleased because you did the Passover per se. He's pleased because we're just doing things that are trying to bring glory to God. It isn't so that the pleasure, the goodness of the act is not grounded in that you're reproducing something in the law. It is founded in the fact that you're doing something to honor God that has to do with some act he did in history. Does that distinction make sense mm-hmm. to you, Amy? So my big question is, why would anybody think that this is somehow the right way to please God in light of the fact that this contract has nothing to do with Gentiles?
I think what's behind it, I think there are two things behind this. And I think the first thing is that people want to please God. Mm-hmm. So they see these commands in the Old Testament and they say, God's commanding this, therefore I should do this. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing I think that's happening. So I think there's something honorable behind this that they want to follow.
Sure.
God.
Let me just jump in before you sure. get far. God's commanding this to a certain
right.
people.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So he commanded Abraham to go to the promised land. Oh, then God would be pleased if we followed the same command? Really? See, that's the problem
right.
I have with that way of looking at it.
Which brings me to the second problem, and that is they don't understand the greater context of these commandments.
Yeah.
They don't understand the New Testament. So much of the New Testament addresses this very issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't even realize this till I started reading it a lot more, and I suddenly realized, oh, yeah, this is a big issue back there.
Mm-hmm.
Romans 7 goes through the whole idea that when we were joined to Christ, because we're in union with Christ, we died to the law. It mm-hmm. says that we died to the law so that we could be joined to another, mm-hmm. to Christ. So, and then he compares it to a woman who's married to a husband. If she joins herself to someone else while her husband is living, then she's an adulteress. But if he dies, she's free from the law to marry another.
Mm-hmm.
So his whole point is we are no longer bound to the law. It's very explicit
but
in chapter 7.
But of course, if a woman if a husband dies, then the woman, if she continues to pretend like she is married to that husband, of course that's pleasing to God, right? Now, this is a parody, obviously.
Yeah, that's,
well, that's
yeah.
so ridiculous. You
yeah.
wouldn't say that. Well, my husband has died, but I am going to pretend like I'm still married to him because God, that would please God. Well, it doesn't please God because it's that system, that obligation, until death do us part, that's over with. And by the same token, it can't inherently please God mm-hmm. for us to continue participating in a system that is now defunct. Look at Jeremiah 31:31. This is the beginning in Jeremiah of the promise of the new covenant. I will make a new covenant with the nation of Israel, not like the old one, which they broke when they came out and received the law there at Sinai, you know. But this is one they can't break. I'll write the laws in the heart, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, even going back to the earliest moments when the new details of the new covenant were given through a Hebrew prophet, what is inherent there is a declaration of the brokenness and, in a certain sense, the inadequacy because of that. Of the old covenant, and therefore something new is being given that mm-hmm. can't be broken.
And of course, Hebrews 8 says that the old covenant is obsolete now. It uses that word to explain, you know, this same thing you're talking. Because I think he quotes that passage right there in Hebrews, if I'm thinking of the right
spot. Yeah, but I think your point, though, that this theme is throughout the New Testament. Is really, really an important one that
well,
people
Well, Galatians, the whole point of Galatians is yeah. that people were saying you need to be circumcised, which is the symbol of their covenant.
Right.
And Paul says, you began with the Spirit. Are you now being perfected by the flesh?
Flesh?
In other
right.
words, you don't improve your sanctification by following these right. Old Testament laws.
Right.
That's the whole book of Galatians.
That's right.
The law was a tutor to bring us to Christ.
Yeah. It's interesting, in chapter 5, it says, if you walk by the Spirit, you will not carry out the desires of the flesh. Of course, the Spirit is a feature of the new covenant. The giving of the Spirit, the way it's done in the New Testament, is a unique feature of the new covenant. And this is why those who walk by the Spirit are already fulfilling the desires of they don't need the law, in a sense, because by the Spirit, that law written on your heart, and we are in the process mm-hmm. of fulfilling that. So again, it's just another way that Paul reiterates this point that one is past and a new thing has come, mm-hmm. you know.
And the Spirit's better because it actually empowers us rather than just condemns us.
Right, right.
So Galatians, Romans 7, Romans 14 goes into the idea of following the feast right. and the Sabbath day. And then I think 1 Corinthians 9.
Well, how about Ephesians 2? You know, it says
the
divide broke down the dividing wall, which is the law and the commandments, which separated the Gentiles from the Jews in a cultural mm-hmm. way. It broke that down, making the two into one new man, being built right. on the foundation of the prophets and the apostles, and Christ Jesus being the cornerstone.
Right.
What could be more clear?
God didn't graft Gentiles into the law. He grafted both Jews and Gentiles into Christ.
Yes. And
that's the idea.
And this is, if we can make a pitch for the Bible Fast Forward, which is a 10-week course, 10 hours, and I give the instruction, there's like 160-page, very detailed outline that goes with it. You know, you can print out if you get that from Standard Reason. But this makes this all very clear. The new covenant is the covenant given to Israel that Gentiles are grafted into. We are made partakers with Christ in virtue of the provisions of the new covenant, not the Mosaic covenant. Mm-hmm. And I go into quite a bit of detail, kind of stepping folks through in a very accessible way in that material, the Bible Fast Forward.
We also have a lot written on our website at str.org. I think the latest one, I wrote a post called Should Followers of Christ Observe the Torah? So if you look that up, there are links to Greg has a piece on how does the Old Testament law apply to Christians today. There are several different pieces on our website. So if you go to Should Followers of Christ Observe the Torah, there are links there and people can find out more information.
Yeah.
This is actually a really big deal right now.
Yeah.
A lot of people are saying we need to follow the law.
Yeah. It's amazing to me when I think about it, since the it's such a so dead end. It's anyway. Well, I don't want to go into more detail there. There was a book that really helped me on this though, and it's called something like 40 Questions About the Old Testament Law, something that to that effect.
Schreiner, was that?
Is that the title?
No,
is
no.
It,
I'm thinking of the author.
No, but
I can't remember.
Did I get the title?
I think
right?
It's something like that. Yeah.
And he makes the same point about this is a covenant with a different people, and to me that really was a great starting point because a contract is only obligatory between the signatories, period.
So here it is. It is a Thomas Schreiner, 40 Questions About Christians and Biblical Law.
There you go. Yeah. How do you do that so quickly? It's amazing to me. You're so good at that, Amy. All right. Well, we've talked a lot about that one.
Okay. So let's go on to the next one. This one is from Fortified Faith Ministries. What do I say to an atheist who doesn't believe because of his political beliefs?
He doesn't believe what, I guess, is
I guess he's resisting Christianity because his political beliefs don't
are inconsistent.
Match. Yeah. That's how I'm interpreting it.
Well, okay. I'm just pausing for a moment because there's a lot of angles to this, and there's different ways one can maneuver, okay? A person has political beliefs because that person believes that there is an appropriate use of power to accomplish certain ends. Now, to say there's an appropriate use of power is just another way to say there is a sound moral use of power, okay, to particular ends. Generally, those ends are, well, they're supposed to be for the common good, which is another moral term, by the way. But a lot of times nowadays, it's people just doing what they want. And so what I'd want to try to figure out is if a person who is an atheist who has certain political views holds those views because of bare self-interest, which would be completely consistent with atheism as a worldview, or because he thinks that there's some kind of moral priority to those views over and against the kinds of views that would follow from a robust Christian worldview. So he might say, well, we should have liberty and we should have freedom and we have the right to do what we want. We have the right to choose. Therefore, we should have a right to an abortion. But if I believed in God and Christianity, then that would be a problem there. So I don't want to believe in God and Christianity. But notice the rationale, the nature of the pushback. It is an appeal to some kind of inherent rights or moral good. But you see, this is a thing that an atheist has no proper claim to, because in an atheistic world, if the atheist is a materialist atheist, which is 99.9%, that is, they don't believe in the supernatural or the immaterial realm, and evolution's the deal, in the beginning were the particles, the cosmos is all there is, ever was and ever will be, well, then there's no morality in that kind of universe. There's not any deep morality. There's just what people want or what they think evolution has conditioned them to believe, but that's not an adequate point of appeal. You can't say, you have to give me my right to an abortion because evolution has taught me to believe I have a right to abortion. Well, who has an obligation to their genetics? That doesn't make any sense at all. So the broader issue here is the atheist is borrowing from the Christian worldview to make his case against the Christian worldview, okay? If you are making a case for your side as an atheist, a materialist, based on some kind of transcendent good, either explicitly or implicitly part of your argument, this is a something you have no right to, because in your view, when I say no right, I mean no intellectual right to. It doesn't make sense in your view. You don't believe in those things. You're a materialist. So why are you smuggling them in and using them as leverage here? If really all you're saying is, I want what I want, then I tip my hat to you for being intellectually honest. But I think most people know better that it isn't just what they want. There are goods that they can appeal to, but now they're operating in our worldview, transcendent goods that need a transcendent God to ground those goods. And if they're going to do that, well, then what matters is what God thinks is good, not what they want. So that's the line of thinking, and the difficulty here is twofold, Amy. As you know, one of them is getting someone to follow that line of thinking, And secondly, getting them to be intellectually honest. And, you know, I don't mean this in pejoratively, but just descriptively, in my experience, neither are the kind of thing that you're going to find a lot in atheists. You're not going to find intellectual honesty, and you're not going to find the ability to rationally follow this argument.
Yeah, I think I would try and bring out that issue with them by just asking them, if Christianity were true, would you want to change your political beliefs to match it? If it were true, just hypothetically, mm-hmm. and see what they say.
Yeah, that gets to one of these issues mm-hmm. about whether they're intellectually, they're really concerned with what's true and right and good. And yeah, that's a good point. And that might be the best way to start, you know, just asking them that.
Yeah, because if you can get them thinking about what's true, because it sounds like he's just giving a pragmatic view. I don't want to change my views, therefore I'm not going to consider any other idea.
Yeah.
But if you can get them thinking about truth and get them to commit to the idea, because most atheists want to commit to the idea that they want to follow what's true, even if they're not doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can get them to say, yes, I would do that, then now you can talk about it.
That's a great starting point, Amy. I wish I would have said that.
Wait, we can go back to this again. I'll let you say it.
But just a postscript to this, I remember Craig Hazen talking once about how he went to an event, like a party, dinner party, something. It was all gay guys. It was all gays, and he was the only one that was straight. And and of course he got put upon for his own views. But then he asked this question. He said, "If there really was a God." Maybe you don't believe, maybe there isn't. But if there was, do you think he would have something legitimately to say about this question, our sexual behaviors? That's kind of a similar
question.
Yeah,
and that would work for this too.
Yeah.
Does he have something to say about politics?
Yeah, right. That's just another way of putting your same mm-hmm. question. And that stopped him in their tracks. And a number of them did admit, well, if he did exist, then he would have something to say about it. Ah, now that shifts the focus to whether or not God exists mm-hmm. in his case or Christianity is true in the way you put it. Good, Amy.
Thank you, Greg.
Give yourself a raise.
I'll do that.
Just
too bad I don't handle the money.
Yeah, just joking.
Well, thank you, everyone. Thank you for listening. We appreciate you listening. Please tell your friends about this and visit our website at str.org. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.